With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to episode 4 of the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm editor-in-chief of Video Ad News, which, as I now say every week, will soon be rebranding to Video Week. This week's guest is Kieran O'Kane, CEO of Wire Corp. Well, I think most people listening to this will associate Kieran with Exchange Wire. Kieran is somebody I'd regard as a good friend, but he's also been one of the most intelligent, outspoken, and passionate industry commentators for over a decade now. As always, if you'd like to support the podcast, you can show us some love on social media or give us a rating in the Apple Podcast Store, which will help other people find the podcast. I'll now cross over to my conversation with Kieran. This was a fun one for me to do, and I hope it's fun for you too. Most of our listeners will probably be familiar with Exchange Wire, but they might not be as familiar with the overarching group. So explain a bit about what Wire Corp is and what you guys are up to.
So, I mean, we started off as Exchange Wire. That was the sort of the blog that I started in 2008, 2009. And obviously everybody's aware of what we sort of wrote about and what we did. I mean, we kind of covered the data-driven marketing space, or the programmatic space, if you will. And we wrote about it, wrote sort of a deep dive sort of analysis around it. And then we ran some events off the back of it called the ATS, or the Ad Trading Summit. And we've gone global with that. And after a couple of years, we kind of launched a couple of other titles. I mean, they'll only be launched in the last 2 or 3 years. So we have the Fast Growth Brands and the Gaming Economy. Fast Growth Brands is covering off sort of that sort of exciting sort of area around challenger brands, direct-to-consumer brands, and sort of digital native brands, which is kind of like the next wave of sort of brands coming through. And then the Gaming Economy is sort of a business title for gaming, which is absolutely massive, as big as the sort of the film industry. So all those three titles are sort of housed under one umbrella title, or one umbrella holding group, which is the Wire Corp. So, you know, we don't see ourselves just as an events company. We do research, we do content. We've got a lot of data products coming out now as well, and we've got very exciting project coming out on Exchange Wire, which sort of is the next evolution of networking, which we will be unveiling in the next couple of weeks, which is going to help buyers and sellers connect. So that's kind of exciting. So yeah, it's sort of a modern B2B company in many ways, and we're sort of, you know, we're moving beyond just one brand, because I think, you know, the digital ecosystem is a lot bigger than just programmatic.
So the industry now is going into, at the very least, a recession. David Williams, I know an Irish economist who you also enjoy, said we might begin to go into what's called, he calls a pandeshion.
Pandeshion, yeah. He and loves that, doesn't he?
it's a great term, because I think in our lifetimes that we've encountered these sort of economic circumstances. Many of the sort of different constituent players in the market, you know, if we bracket them all, have had concerns about their futures, I think, to some degree. Although I think we both disagree that, you know, the industry sometimes talks in zero-sum terms, as if certain company types are going to go completely extinct, whereas they rarely ever do. But let's just have a sort of go through the different sort of categories and sort of have a little assessment of how they're likely to fare during the pandemic, and sort of see where they were at going into all of this. Let's maybe start with ad tech.
What do you think is the state of ad tech today? I know that's a broad question, but
I mean, I think ad tech was facing sort of existential crisis even before the pandemic. Thank you, David. The demise of third party cookies, which was enabling quite a lot of the, which basically was underpinning quite a lot of the infrastructure for data driven marketing or data driven buying, was sort of slowly ebbing away because of various things such as the sort of ITP crackdown by Safari. And obviously the announcement by Chrome that they were getting rid of third party cookies, whatever that means, sort of put the industry on alert. So they were already facing into something big like that. So this is just probably the pandemic has probably accelerated some of the things that was going to happen to ad tech. So it's sort of a decrease in the number of vendors in the middle, so to speak, because there is quite a lot of vendors that sit between the publisher and the buyer at the minute. And do we need that number really in the long term when a handful could probably do with a lower margin? So, you know, ad tech was always, there's a lot of, school of thought, particularly from the likes of Brian O'Kelly, who obviously was the former CEO of AppNexus before he moved on to his new calling in logistics. But he always maintained that that we were heading to a single digit margin business, particularly around the transaction of impressions in the programmatic world. So ad tech is sort of in this weird sort of state now where it's particularly in digital display. When I mean digital display, Vinny, I mean like video and online banners, so to speak. It's in this kind of weird, it's going to contract. The number of companies that's going to contract a little bit in the middle. But in a broader term, I think ad tech has got a bright future because the one thing that ad tech does that no other sort of layer can, it sort of is the monetization engine for media, right? It sort of helps media just generate money, right? When you think about Google and Facebook, and Snap and Pinterest, they have like massive user-facing businesses, right? Google builds all these utility apps that are used by hundreds of millions of billions of people, and likewise Facebook. But at their core, they're ad tech companies, right? They're advertising business. They're built on ad tech structures. So I believe that ad tech has this innate ability to take certain media, all forms of media, and sort of help it monetize. So there is this narrow view that ad tech is some kind of like retargeting, data grabbing, and it's a dirty type of thing. But actually, it's not, because it's actually got real value in terms of what it does for media owners and media buyers. So I'm very bullish on the ad tech future. But when I look at sort of the things that ExchangeWire looked at, which is the display ecosystem, I think that is going to contract a little bit, not to the detriment of constituent players. I think the guys that survive that will be left in that display ecosystem are going to do very, very well. They're going to be phenomenally successful and profitable companies. I mean, Google is overarching for sure, but there is enough room for people in the industry, and we'll probably go into it again, Vinny, but Google and Facebook own parts of the ecosystem. They don't own the whole lot. And data is important, but I feel that we're heading into this world as well where, because of the demise of the cookie, we're getting into a world of fragmentation. So walled gardens everywhere. And that, for me, speaks of opportunity, particularly for ad tech, who could be trying to build bridges between all of these different ecosystems. So I'm very bullish on ad tech in the long term.
I think consolidation is inevitable in some sense, in that some companies have not been running profitably, then have been sort of running at a slight loss, and it's inevitable that their VC money will run out at some point, and they'll go off to ad tech heaven, or But there are, one of the things you touched on there was ITP, which is, you know, internet tracking prevention in the browsers, and the demise of the cookie. I mean, as we sort of have to branch out and find these new identity solutions, is there new opportunities going to be? I know you've written about vertical ad networks before. Do you want to maybe explain a little bit about your thoughts on vertical ad networks and how that model could work? And do you not think that we could see maybe new players flourish in that kind of new space?
Yeah, I think that ironically, you know, Apple has done the ad tech ecosystem a really big favor, right? Much of the current ad tech infrastructure is built on Google's cookie, right? The double click cookie, right? It controls that sort of open web. Because Safari's thrown this sort of privacy wrench into the ad tech machine, it's making people rethink about how they target users in a privacy forced way and be compliant with the ITP protocols on Safari browser and Firefox and the rest. Measurement, because that's a key piece that we have to measure the efficacy of the spend that we put into display and other channels. So there's a huge opportunity there for people to build next generation privacy forced businesses. And I guess it's going to be hard because a lot of the businesses that we know, Vinny, they're built on top of the cookie infrastructure. And it's tough when you've taken all that money, VC money, to rebuild the business. But there are so many smart people in ad tech. It's one of those kind of businesses that keeps evolving, right, with the problems around it. And I think that there's going to be a wave of really good businesses building the next gen of targeting, measurement, and attribution. And I think it's very exciting. In terms of like where I might see the opportunities, I feel that there are a ton of companies sitting on advertising businesses that they don't realize. So Samsung, I believe, have an ads business, but they've gone all in on the CTV piece. But they own the hardware, they own the TVs, and they own the operating system. So, you know, that's their main business, but they have utility, but they also have unbelievable sort of the ability to be that gatekeeper for a massive CTV business. So, I think that there's going to be, and I think this is where ad tech comes in as well, because it's like the ad tech can plug into that and power that business. So I think that's going to be, the opportunity is huge. I mean, of course, it's going to be pain and struggle to move from that cookie-based business to the new privacy-first business. And you referred to the vertical ad networks. My thinking around that is that there is going to be opportunity for businesses to work with a tight number of publishers in a niche, right? So what I believe is there'll still be horizontal buys, which is your Facebook, your Google, and your Amazon, which have massive scale, massive first-party data that can do that type of horizontal scale buying, right? But there will be opportunities for companies to build vertical capabilities. So around, you know, like health and wellness. So if you could basically work with like 100 publishers or 50 publishers on a first party basis, you could build a really strong business. And it might not be the 100 or 200 or 300 or 400 million pound business that you thought it was or be acquired for, but they'll certainly be profitable and viable and have longevity because A, you'll have, you know, taken on that publisher relationship and have deep relationships with the publishers and can work on a first party basis. So that means that you probably can target and measure across Safari in your network, right? Not, it would be publisher based, but you'll be better than most companies who are trying to basically run campaigns across Safari. So I think that there's going to be just pockets of opportunity to build really good businesses. And, you know, I have a lot of, again, I'm bullish. I take, okay, maybe we can't build the 100 to 200 million pound business, but who cares? They're like long shots, you know, and it's tough to do that type of business in this part of the world. It's just really, really difficult. You know, we're talking about, you're talking about Europe or even Asia or South America versus the US, which is, you know, whatever, 25, 30% of the entire advertising market globally, and has a scaled 350 million person English speaking market. You know, they have a homogenous market where you could where you can actually scale those businesses. But in this part of the world, we have to think like a bit more like street fighters, like scrappy street fighters, you know. We have to build businesses that suit the ecosystem that we work in.
And I think that's something that many international companies often fail to do. You know, I've heard of many a European ad tech executive say that, you know, in order for them to build their business in Sweden, they need to have feature X, but the engineers, you know, often US-based, but not necessarily, often don't have the resource or the desire to build something for what is a relatively small pocket of inventory in a global context, but would be critical to scaling a European business. So, yeah, I think I agree with you on that. What about the agencies? You know, I don't think I did say at the beginning that we'd sort of talk about them in the context of the pandemic. I hope I'm not annoying people by repeatedly using this word. But, you know, I don't think we should read too much into layoffs, you know, in the short term when people are being walloped. And yes, was, you know, clients are sort of hitting the pause button on spend. But, you know, what do you think of the agency model, you know, up until a few months ago? And what do you think the future holds for it?
So there's a prevailing negativity around the agency model, the holding group model. But they have the capability of evolving, I think. I mean, there's lots of sort of different views. I mean, obviously, Sir Martin Sorrell, you know, left WPP and he's now built S4 Capital in a space of 2 years. It has a billion pound market cap right now. And his ethos is building on, you know, digital first and sort of programmatic and data. So he kind of has a different view. I mean, I think agencies are kind of are in a tricky enough spot because they have, you know, they're fairly sizable businesses. And you know, they are very reliant on TV money in terms of margin. And I suppose digital, they still make not as much money, but I don't know. They're such, they can evolve. I just don't see, they might be smaller post pandemic because of layoffs, but they're one of those businesses where they're people dependent, so they can lay off people and bring them back on, like, you know what I mean? They don't have a lot of cost other than that, except maybe the expensive leases they have on offices globally. I mean, I think they'll probably, when I think about agencies as well, I think about service layer, right? So, you know, when I think of the holding groups, I still think about service layer. There will always be a service layer between the marketer and the rest of the ecosystem, because it's difficult. There was a whole sort of trend around in-housing and there was a media frenzy about companies bringing stuff in-house, and, you know, it wasn't really true at all. I mean, there was definitely technology contracts were being centralized by procurement, which was rightly, it was the right thing to do from a brand perspective, but execution and strategy and planning and still being done at the agency level. And for me, I think it always would be done at the agency level. My view is the holding groups are not going out of business. And there's a lot of like people who think that's the case, but I've been covering the business been covering this business for better part 12, 13 years, and I just think and see that they're quite, you know, they're survivors, you know what I mean? They can survive this type of thing, and they'll evolve. What they will look like post COVID will be interesting to see. Will Martin Sorrell be S4 Capital and others like his company be as big as Holding Groups? Maybe, but I'm still fairly sure that in 12, 24 months' time, there will be agencies still here.
Equally, I think an effect of the recession is going to be that we're going to see brands laying off their marketing teams as well. And then once business resumes, they're going to want to scale up and they're going to need quick, ready help and instant expertise, which I think is what agencies offer. You know, again, I completely agree with you. I think.
And then, Vinny, if you cut across as well. And the more the ecosystem becomes complex, which it is, right? Imagine, you know, you've got, instead of like three walled gardens, we now have 100. How do you navigate all that? Like, agencies are going to be able to help marketers transition to that new reality. And particularly around, you know, cookieless technology. Like, I just think that brands just won't have that internal capability to make that. I mean, some of them will, for sure. And I'm not kind of being derogatory towards brands, but they've got other key tasks they need to get on with, other than just sort of figuring out how to target and measure users across Safari, you know?
So I agree. I think that there's so much complexity in the system that, like I say, that they're going to need expertise and people who have experience of all these different walled gardens. And then again, when you extrapolate that across multiple global markets, you're looking at a very sort of dizzying picture that isn't necessarily something that can be accessed by a single DSP, for example, or even two or three. You need sort of boots on the ground negotiating deals. So moving on to the sell side, the publishers have had, you know, I think quite a difficult few years. I think there's a few different narratives, you know, about what the future of publishers will be, that, you know, moving towards a cookieless, you know, a cookieless world will ultimately, you know, lead to people returning to context, and everyone's, you know, basically going to be paying $19.99 prices for digital again. And then, you know, there's another narrative that, you know, in the absence of data, you know, an impression has significantly less value and people will pay less, which I'm not entirely sure I agree with, because everybody will be on the same playing field. What's your view on the state of publishers? By that, I think, you know, let's talk about the web per publishers first.
Initially. Right. I think it's a difficult situation for a lot of web publishers, like particularly newspaper publishers. They've had a pretty awful time, especially during this pandemic outbreak. You know, we've had the whole controversy over keyword blocking. Like, I don't know if you've trolled through some of the websites during the day, like, but I keep seeing like cloudy MPUs. And for your listeners, that would be a ad verification company who basically ensure that a brand's ad is not appearing against any erroneous content. They will replace the ad with a placeholder or some kind of, you know, ad that suggests that an ad's been blocked, and that's terrible for a publisher because that's lost revenue. And the brands have been deliberately not buying against Corona because they see it as damaging to their brand, which is utter nonsense, because Corona is everywhere. I mean, like, you know, you need to kind of like look at sort of the upside here. Like, in the stories about heroic NHS efforts, surely like your brand is going to get, you know, brand equity by being associated with that piece. Likewise, if it's about community spirit and all the rest of it, I mean, all the stories aren't terrible, but it's been hard for publishers because, you know, they're so reliant on ad revenue. So they've all kind of gone down the route of trying to build their subscriptions, and some have been successful and others haven't. I mean, we all cannot pay for everything. And I think ad revenue is still important in terms of what, you know, how that helps publishers. And obviously it keeps the web open and it helps publishers, you know, cover, you know, keep politicians honest and cover hard stories so that we need to know about. So it's a tough space, but I'm still bullish. I mean, I think this is going to be a rocky period for a lot of them, but I think that publishers will find that sweet spot between ad revenue and subscription revenue and e-commerce revenue. So, you know, I think the publishers are going to become very, very diverse in their revenue streams. And as you know, they need to be, because selling ads is hard, right? And you've just alluded to the fact that the cookie disappearing raises some problems. But there are new companies coming along, Vinny, that are going to help plug that gap. I'm pretty much convinced about it, that, you know, you've got companies that will be built for the new age and help publishers sort of navigate that. And I think, I'm always taking the optimistic line, because like the prevailing mood is all about negativity. When everybody starts being positive in you, I'll be the negative one. I mean, that's the way I usually work. I'm the contrarian about this. So I think publishers will do okay. I think it's going to be a tough couple of years, but I think they're going to figure a way through this.
Just on the subscription side of things, why do you think that we've not seen a microtransaction system that has worked, or why we haven't seen, you know, more of the, you know, the slightly lower tier publishers who might have a slightly less compelling subscription offering, but, you know, if they were grouped together with 20 other websites, you might happily chuck in some subscription revenue. Is there any reason you think that we haven't seen this work?
I think it just has to be done properly. You know, when you're asked for cash, like, it's a bit of a, you just get your back up a little bit, doesn't it? Like, I mean, I don't know about you, but there is ways of gamifying this. I saw a really interesting app in China where they were basically a podcast app that had like 90 million subscribers. And they were trying to figure out a way to monetize their actual, their solution. And they went down their idea of whether showing ads or an outright subscription model. And they felt that wasn't really in the spirit of what, you know, what they're trying to do, because, you know, the content they were presenting their users with was fun and engaging. So they're trying to figure out a way around it. So instead, what they did was that the users could buy gifts, virtual gifts. So you could basically award a podcast or piece of content with a gift. It could be like a beer, or it could be like a martini, or it could be whatever. And that money can then be actually sort of banked by the content producer. So I just think there's ways. I just think more creative ways that we can sort of think about this. And I think it's. I think micropayments will come eventually, but it's going to be done in a more fun and social kind of way. I think I can imagine an SDK for an app or something like that, which would help make that happen. But I could see a situation that like that happening. It just micropayments for me just doesn't feel right in terms of like how it's executed right now.
No, I've frequently come across, I mean, there's, you just have a certain amount of bandwidth when it comes to financial bandwidth. I mean, when it comes to how many things you're willing to subscribe to. There's certain publications where I would love to access an individual article without having to subscribe, and would happily pay 50p, sometimes even, you know, a pound, just to read a single article. And all it has to be a very quick one punch button, top right. It's a
yes, but if you had an overlaying piece of technology that plugged into all of those things instead of, like, you know. I just think there's a better way of doing it. I you know, but then again, scaling those propositions is tough. You know what I mean? Why hasn't it been done by now? And then you've got to train behavior, which takes time as well. You know, I mean, you could argue you could publish the whole lot on Facebook, and Facebook could build that type of functionality into their platform easily. I mean, they're doing it with Instagram, you know, with the e-commerce side, why couldn't they do it with content? That would be my sort of opinion around it.
Right, finally, let's move on to the marketers, who I probably should have started with to begin with. If you're a marketer, I mean, we're only a few weeks away from the ISPA report. And I think, like, there's, you know, again, which I think sort of fueled a certain amount of marketer despondency when they sort of look at the industry. Do you think marketers are getting good value in digital today, and are they being treated fairly, do you think?
So I could see both sides of the argument on the ISPA stuff, or the ISPA PwC report.
Yeah.
I on first glance, when you see those numbers, and you think, oh my God, where's all my money going? Oh, what is this ad tech layer, right? I would say there's rightly outrage from their procurement teams and all the rest of it. Well, if I'm spending a dollar, I want to be spending a dollar. That's just, but then, like, stepping back from that, you just think that's nonsense, right? That's not how things work. You know, if you're a marketer, you'll have strict KPIs around how you want your campaigns to work, right? When you start spending the money on Google, right, how much is actually going to Google? Like, you've no idea, right? But there's a performance KPI, right? There's an outcome there. So I think that this is just, I think there's good questions being asked about the supply chain, right? There's good questions being asked, where is that money going? How does it flow to the publisher? But if the marketer really wants to spend a pound with a publisher, they should go and talk to the publisher. So you just rip out all that tech, but then how do you target? How do you measure? How do you make that dollar work towards your KPI? And that's the kind of things that ad tech does, right? Yeah. Maybe there's too many layers and there's too much money being taken out, which I do believe there is. But I think there's too much hysteria around the money. And I respect the PwC job, but you know, they also are an auditing business. They also have skin in the game. So I'm not challenging their integrity, but you have to ask questions about, are they conflicted, you know, a little bit.
Well, I do know somebody, and I won't name the person, but they weren't from an ad tech founder or anything else. And they did say that you could quite easily, well, not easily, but you could have put in extra work in order to fully assess where that 50% was. That it is possible to do it, but that the methodology didn't really allow for that. It didn't go deep enough.
But if marketers are really that annoyed about it, I mean, they can push back. And I think some of the costs could be, and in fairness to some of the agencies, I know a few agencies have taken a lot of that supply chain on board and have basically whacked a lot of margin off top of that, right? So, but I didn't see Facebook and Google being included in that report, or Amazon. How much margin do they take? I think it's very unfair sometimes that independent ad tech gets smashed to pieces and that Google don't. And I just find it annoying, to be frank, because they were asked that question outright on an Ad Exchanger podcast and they dodged the question, which I found was just, you know, not particularly fair. Given that ad tech, independent ad tech is getting in the rear, so yeah, to speak, around this. But marketers are right to ask the questions, but I also think that the hysteria has been too much.
I think it's fair to say. And I think it's a question of understanding. I think when you're talking about, you know, a missing delta and mystery money,
yeah, 15%. Where is that 15% gone to? I mean, who knows?
Perhaps some did end up, you know, that there was some sort of dodgy activity going on behind the scenes somewhere. I'm really not saying it wasn't, but apparently that, you know, when you just perhaps haven't investigated quite enough to establish where that money ended up, to say it's missing or unexplained. Is probably a little unfair.
It was a bit sensationalist as well. Like, you know what I mean? That's what every single, like, press release was leading with. And I thought, like, it's important that you have these conversations about supply chain, right? It's very important. You've got to ask the questions, right? But I don't think this sort of notion a parent should be a parent is just completely crazy. Because if that's the case, then just call the publisher direct and just buy a bunch of inventory the whole year and see if it works. How do we measure? How do we target? Where's my attribution? Where's my ad verification? You know what I mean? How do I ad serve it? How much is that going to cost? You know what I mean? Those things are not really taken into account. How do I plan this?
Yeah.
So, you know, who do I blame when the campaign goes wrong?
Yeah.
I mean. it's a little bit, I think grown-up conversations are required, but it just felt so sensationalist. I just think that in an age when it's just, we're just dramas every day, like, I think it would be better to have grown-up conversations and talking to the key players going, can we figure out a way to reduce some of the margin being taken in that transaction?
I think often these reports are political in nature and they're very much designed to push for further transparency, which is a great thing. But I also think that in tandem with that transparency conversation needs to be an honest conversation about ensuring that agencies get paid properly for the work they're doing, because we all know that, you know, agencies are called in. Often they spend, you know, months working on a pitch, and the client has invited in several other agencies. They're just not really respecting anyone's time. You know, everybody's putting months of work into these pitches, going in, you know, winning some, losing some. And then ultimately, after all their work, time and time again, we see clients choosing on price. You know, they're just choosing the agency based on price alone. And I'm sure this doesn't happen all the time, but there are countless examples of this. And then the agency is in a spot where they actually have to deliver that, so which incentivizes all sorts of other, you know, ways of trying to recoup their income. So the whole thing needs to be sorted out. I don't pretend to have the answer to it, but I think the dynamics just seem to be a bit warped. What about GAFA? Let's talk about the
GAFA tip.
The platforms on the GAFA tip. You know, we're seeing, you know, one of the things we've covered a fair bit lately has been the, you know, the movement towards antitrust, which I think many people are cynical about, you know, in terms of whether there'll be any actual outcome. I think there's also some, you know, quite reasonable arguments, you know, about whether they actually do control the market. And what's your feeling on the antitrust side of things? Do you think we'll start to see these companies being broken up?
No. I don't. I think the world has changed. You know, I think, like, if you'd asked me this question 24 months ago, yes, I thought, like, Google had this absolute stranglehold on the entire ecosystem. But now we have a situation where Safari has blocked third-party cookies. So Amazon, Facebook, and Google cookies don't work across that ecosystem, which, let's be honest with you, the Apple user is the most sought-after user in the world because they've got most money. Anybody with Apple devices generally are wealthier, in my view, in the US and elsewhere.
We're both on Android, I believe, aren't we?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a Pavo. I'm an Android. It's broken
me too.
Up this stage.
Me too. Yeah.
But I'm not. That's a kind of broad generalization. But in the mean, you know, broadly, you could argue that Safari segment is very, very valuable. So now Facebook and Google and Amazon have been blocked from those specific areas. And I think that what we're seeing is media has become much more fragmented, right? Okay, Facebook and Google are kind of taking the lion's share, and Amazon are taking the lion's share of digital spend. But when I think about digital, I'm thinking beyond just banners and video ads. I'm thinking about what's becoming digitized. So we think about digital at home, right? You think about the CTV ecosystem, you think about gaming. These companies have a foothold in these spaces, but they're not dominant, right? And I think that you have these sort of themes happening, right? So Huawei is very interesting for me, right? So Huawei is obviously being stripped off the OS Android ecosystem that Google has, right? So now it has to develop its own operating system. So it actually is going to build its own ad ecosystem on top of that. That for me is fascinating because that's a huge segment of the world's telco market, right? They sell an enormous, huge amount of phones every year in China and in India and other areas. So they're going to build their own ecosystem. So that's one massive walled garden. You know, I alluded to Samsung earlier on. You know, they've got a massive opportunity around their TVs and their operators to build a huge CTV business. It's absolutely huge. You know, we've got Spotify in the audio space. And you've got all these businesses popping up, like, you know, the broadcasters are building their own walled gardens. And I feel that the situation has become way more complicated than it was before, you know. And you could argue, oh, you should, you know, break WhatsApp away from Facebook because they've got all this power. But look at the success of TikTok. You know what I mean? TikTok has been an absolute monster in the last, in terms of growth, in the last 12, 24 months. So you've got all these companies popping up, like nobody has a secure footing. I mean, Google is growing because search is still strong, but they're decelerating in other areas of businesses. So while I think that we should muzzle them, we shouldn't let them acquire companies, eventually things will reach an equilibrium around this. I don't know why, I just came to that view recently. I used to be an ardent break them up person, but actually I think the world is a lot more complicated than it was some time ago. You know, I do think that the likes of Amazon and e-commerce needs to be checked, put in check. I would like to see more European businesses competing with those companies, but it's difficult, I guess, because Amazon are such a monster. But there are ways to keep them in check, Vinny. I think like keeping them, making them, restricting them to not buying specific companies is a start. I mean, the Facebook Giphy thing, I think that should be slapped down because I think Giphy could be a little hidden gem in the right pair of hands, you know?
I think, I feel less strongly about Giphy, but I think a lot of the regulators missed the boat with things like Instagram and WhatsApp.
Instagram was tough. I think WhatsApp was bigger. I think they're giving Facebook the WhatsApp, solution was a mistake.
I think at the time, they probably imagined that Instagram would just be rolled into Facebook and become a kind of some sort of photo feature of Facebook rather than being this phenomenally successful, massive product in its
own right. But there's an awful lot to be in admiration of Facebook for taking that asset that was doing well and turning it into an absolute juggernaut, like in terms of the business it is now, you know. And this is why I think Facebook is such a good company in that sense. You know, its business is amazing, but you know, obviously it's got other problems around the social havoc it's caused globally. But you know, it's complicated, Vinny. I mean, I antitrust is the laws are sort of slightly out of date as well. So, but I think that when those companies get bigger, they get lazier, right? And great companies pop up, and they'll do some interesting stuff. And I think that's going to happen.
I think that's quite true. I think the diversification of digital makes it hard to be, you know, you can very easily find yourself being jack of all trades, master of none. I think there's an argument to be said for having products integrated, which I would say Google do extremely well, in that everything is quite, you know, maybe not always seamlessly, but often seamlessly integrated with their other existing products, and that, you know, regardless of what you're doing, I think they understand that integration piece will often give you leverage, you know, if you control. It is DB360 now. But, you know, if you're controlling buy side tools, that could be leverage when it comes to integrations with sell side tools. And I can see that there might be a case for splitting up some different parts of this ecosystem, but I don't think it'll be in any way disastrous for the company. And even if they were forced to spin it out as a standalone asset,
if they were standalone companies, Google's shareholders are doing very well. Think about YouTube as a standalone. I know Professor Galloway says this all the time, but like, you know, shareholders would do really well. YouTube as a standalone company would be a seriously successful business because A, it could just turn the search business on straight away. It would have the CTV business as well. It would be an absolute huge success. I think, if anything, Google's just, you know, not really, not sort of realizing the potential of that company. I don't know if that's deliberate or not, because obviously they're afraid of antitrust, but think about what YouTube would be, because it's the second biggest search engine in the world, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not sure. Amazon.
I think it's in the top three anyway, but that's a significant business.
Yeah. You mentioned about, you know, European innovation. I think that's something we've spoken about a lot, you know, in terms of, I think for a while, at least, we were a bit confused about why we weren't seeing a bit more homegrown companies popping up when it came to, particularly ad tech. You know, that's not to belittle the great ones that do exist. But why do you think we haven't seen more than we have?
It's the obvious, isn't it? We touched on it earlier on. The US is a different universe, you know what I mean? It's huge in terms of scale, in terms of ad spend, in terms of the size of the market and the ability to scale it, because you only have one language. You have, you know, one law, or, you know, one sort of rule of law in the country. I know you've got federal and you've got state laws, but generally speaking, it's easy to navigate. I'm not surprised that we've seen most of the ad tech innovation coming from that part of the world. And there's been some sort of outlier successes in Europe, like Criteo, OpenWeb, which is predominantly Russian, but obviously based in London, but it's been a phenomenal success in terms of what's built. But I just think that Europe and Asia, they're, you know, we're talking about, you know, a lot of different nations, a lot of different laws, a lot of different languages. You know, I always laugh at some of the ad tech companies coming to London thinking that they've conquered Europe. They're in London, like, until they get to the likes of fucking Germany, where it's got five different, you know, centers of business. You know, France is its own thing with its own employment laws, and you know, Southern Europe has different sort of barriers as well. You know, I think this fragmentation has made it difficult to scale businesses in Europe. And Criteo have been phenomenal. They've done an unbelievable job of sort of building their business, and more power to them. I know they're going through a bit of a rough spot at the minute, but I'm pretty sure that they will evolve into something stronger and have longevity post cookie. I think in the broadest term, I think what the Europeans do well is to take the tools that the Americans build. And I think AppNexus being a very good example, right? So Brian O'Kelly, brilliant innovator, builds AppNexus with the view of allowing companies to build on top of that platform. And I guess that's what Europeans and the Asians do well in terms of like building businesses on top of that platform. Okay, so Brian's got his 150 engineers in New York who build this amazing platform and let us build on top of their APIs and do some cool stuff. So then you see all these amazing businesses blossom on the platform, and MediaIQ or MIQ is a good example of that. So Europeans are able to take those tools and sort of apply them to the market dynamics within Europe, right? So I would say that for the most part, outside of Europe, outside of the US, agencies are still dominant, right? So brand direct spend is non-existent in many ways. There are exceptions to that rule, particularly around performance and search. But for the most part, display advertising or digital advertising as a whole is very much sort of centered or concentrated within the massive holding groups and sort of independent agencies outside the US. Mm. So it's been able to take those tools and building business around that. So when I talk about that, I'm talking about ad networks, right? Which is probably one of the most maligned business models in our industry, and I would say it's probably the most successful business model of all time. And ad networks can add real value, right? In terms of like data aggregation, performance, those are key things for agencies and brands. So I think that the European model is all about taking the tools and building businesses on top of that. You know, AppNexus is obviously now sucked into Xandr, and Xandr's been sucked into AT&T. And we're kind of, it'd be great to see another platform business like that appear that would help the next wave of companies to build on top of that. But, you know, in fairness to Google, actually, Google have sort of opened up, their platform a little bit to some kind of innovation. And there's companies definitely building businesses off the back of that. But it's difficult when we compare like to like. I think the US is so much different from the rest of the world. Maybe China's the exception, but China's got a lot of ad networks as well. It's got a weird ecosystem as well. So I think that's probably the reason why we haven't seen those scale companies, Vinny. And also, I don't think that the VCs have the same kind of appetite for risk here. Like, you know, in the US, you see like massive raises for ad tech companies. I mean, obviously that's dried up because over the last 12, 24 months, but there's still, the ability to raise in the US is bigger than any elsewhere, because there's concentration of capital there. And there's probably people who are investing in companies that have previously sold ad tech companies.
But also, yeah, the immediate short-term opportunity is bigger in the domestic market, I think, as well, where, you know, it, just to set up, you know, nationally in the US requires a huge amount of investment, and the opportunity is much bigger, and you can make quite a rational case for that you are going after that opportunity.
Sure, there's probably ad networks in US, really, that we don't know about. That's probably making 50 to 100 million pounds a year.
Oh, there would be
in some armpit in the US. That's absolutely huge.
Yeah,
you know, focusing on mattress brands. You know what I mean?
It is.
Or Gatorade or some mad drink we never heard of, like, you know. But it's like, I know for a fact that the US is, the money, the IOs is just, you know, eye popping. You know, it's an absolutely huge market. And it's funny, when I talk to some of the the companies that have built businesses, and they say to me, that particularly the French, I think the French for some reason have been adept at building really proper ad tech companies. When I think about it, you know, Criteo and Aguri and Sticky Ads and Teeds, you know, they have a long list of successes in actually building ad tech. And when companies like that from other parts of Europe come to me and they say, where should we go next? We should go to the London. And I said, no, go to the US. And just, you're going to burn some cash, but once you're in, and you'll make a ton of money. You'll just be printing money. So, you know, that's kind of the advice I give. It's just, you know, do I scale in Italy and Spain and Greece and France? Or do I take that money and hire a bunch of lads and ladies in Chicago, New York, and LA? I think you're going to do the US thing, because you're going to burn through a lot of cash, but you're going to make a ton of money back. And there's been loads of examples of companies that have done that.
When it comes to looking at the future, if I was to pop 100 million in your pocket, what would you invest in today? What do you think?
Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I mean,
where's the big opportunities in the future in our industry is essentially what I'm asking you.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious ones right now for me are gaming. You know, it's again a much maligned channel, if we can use that word channel, but a much maligned ecosystem for brands. You've always kind of associated gaming with sort of like, you know, lazy teenagers and people who don't spend money, but that's actually not, that's an erroneous remark or thinking, in the sense that it's predominantly played by housewives and young women on the tube, like, you know, the Candy Crush saga, it's got a massive female user base. So I think that I've seen a lot of ad tech companies pop up in gaming, and I think it's just big enough to kind of sustain those new companies in that space. And we've seen some mega raises in that space. Iron Source there recently raised a huge round from a private equity firm to buy out a bunch of equity in that company. So I see that as a huge opportunity, because I think brand thinking is going to change around gaming. And, you know, obviously CTV is growing, but gaming offers a massive scale opportunity for video as well. I know it's not exactly sort of television quality ads, but like, we're talking about incentivized video here. But then YouTube is incentivized video, because you have to watch 6 seconds to get to watch your favorite piece of content on YouTube. But I think that's an area that I would be piling money into, because I think it's, if anything, it's still going to grow. You know, COVID is going to ingrain a lot of habits and user behavior. And I think that's one of the things that's going to come out of this. Gaming is going to become bigger. Whether that's, you know, casual gaming or console or whatever. And you know yourself, you've covered yourself as well, Vinny, that, you know, TV gaming, Google are obviously all in it, Apple are all in it. You know, they want to stream it to TV and make it easier for people to use it. So the opportunity for me in that is massive. You know, digital out of home is interesting as well. Out of home is quite a legacy-driven ecosystem. It's tough to navigate, but the opportunity is huge around it, and it's ripe for disruption. I think there's a couple of things missing, particularly around targeting and measurement. So if a company's out there that could do that, I think there's a huge opportunity to build some very, very interesting business in that. I've alluded before, I think that where there's a huge opportunity is in companies that are sitting on first party data. I call them utility publishers. So Samsung for me would be a utility publisher. Companies that kind of have lots of logged in data that don't realize they're going to be very interesting advertising business post cookie. And I think that's those are companies that I would be looking at. I mean, they already exist, but if there's companies out there that can figure out a way to help them to activate those businesses, I think that could be quite interesting. And then there's just the markets that are growing. I mean, Southeast Asia is growing. It's a huge opportunity. China in and out. So, you know, brands looking to market to users outside China. I think that brands looking to get into China. I think there's just a massive story around that over the next, decade, because we are still at the beginning of the decade here. Yeah, those are the things that excite me. I think the same narrative could be applied to identity, Vinny, because obviously that's one of the areas that is so open right now in terms of like, how do we solve this problem? And I think there's going to be some good companies built around that. So yeah, I that's where I would spend my 100 million.
Your fund.
Yeah, where if you could get that to me, like, you know, I mean, there's so many interesting spaces that I think haven't really been explored yet. And I think we're very, very boxed in our thinking right now. But what I'm seeing now is people who have had that addiction to cookie-based buying and cookie-based companies are starting to evolve their thinking beyond that. So how can we actually build value for marketers in these other ecosystems?
Well, listen, Kieran, that was great. Thanks a million for coming on. And yeah, we'll have to have you back on some other time.
Thank you, Vinny. It was my pleasure. I enjoyed talking about the industry and trying to give some hope to people out there.
Very inspirational. All right, cheers. I'll let you get on with your day.